When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I want winners. I want people that want to win.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game.
Come after me! I'm a man!
This week on Double Dragon, NFL analyst Fran Duffy is back to help Steve and I do a season review, and we also offer up a few postseason awards. Then to help me gear up for Electric Boogaloo, check that out over at Bald Move's primary House of the Dragon podcast feed. I talk religion with a specialist on religion in the early modern period. His name is Brendan Walsh, and he comes to us all the way from Australia. Okay. Without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne and analyst Fran Duffy. So, Fran, we've got some trouble in the streets here. It's a big problem with the fan base. They're divided themselves, blacks versus greens. You're an expert on Philadelphia fans in general. What advice can you give to the fandom? Shall we just lean into this? Shall we just become our worst selves? Or shall we find some degree of civility here?
I mean, unfortunately, I don't know that there's much work to be done to fix this, because I feel like that's part of our society, right? It's either it's one side or the other. It's, you know, there's all kinds of analogies I can make here, but it's tough to find that gray area sometimes. So it feels like we almost have to lean into this, right? In that it is going to be the Hightowers versus the Targaryens, and you pick one side, and if you're on the other side, then screw you, and if not, then you're on our side, and you're welcome all day.
Steve, do you have an opinion on this?
On Philadelphia?
We'd love to hear what it's like to be a fan that has opinions and disagrees with other fans. And, you know, we'd like some advice from you on this.
Going back to Philadelphia really quick, it's just really strange for me to be like seeing Philadelphia as the good guy in this situation. Like, that's weird for me.
For what it's worth.
you just got socks full of batteries, and you're like, well, I mean, I guess we're on the right side of history today. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, it's,
what would be the House of the Dragon equivalent to booing Santa Claus? What would that look like for House of the Dragon?
That's a good question. I guess.
I mean, there's no one in the show that really is.
Yeah,
praiseworthy.
We don't have that character. Character yet.
Yeah.
Maybe cheering when the dragon chomps the other dragon at the end.
All right. As Harrenhal burns, we cheer and applaud.
So our advice to the fandom, try to be as civil as a Philadelphia fan. You know, that's the most aspirational thing that we could hope for at this point.
That's the code I live by personally in my everyday life. So I think that'll work for everybody.
You're very good.
Yeah,
very
but
good.
These buses aren't going to set fire to themselves.
All right. So we're doing our second edition of the Sports Talk approach to House of the Dragon. Here's my first question. Which coach gets canned first? Otto for planning an assassination on Allison's childhood best friend, or Damon for strangling the star player of the Blacks? Which coach gets canned first? Steve?
Oof. I don't think it's Otto. I think Otto's got he's too Bill Belichick. I mean, that's what I see.
You think he's too good? He can just do whatever he wants.
I think. Well, if you look at it, if those are the two main criteria that we're looking at here, you know, which I would say that maybe Damon is closer to Draymond punching Jordan Poole.
I was thinking Sprewell. Sprewell actually did choke PJ Carlissimo.
Yeah, I would say that. I think Otto has. I mean, his even though there's an assassination in there, I think we've already discussed that. It almost seems like it's an understood thing that if there is a challenge to what is deemed the proper succession, then it's okay to go ahead and eliminate that potential challenge, even if that challenge never actually. Actually manifest.
So you're suggesting that Otto's not doing anything untoward. It's in the playbook. This is actually in the playbook. It's legit. It's a legit legal play.
If you look under the box lid of Game of Thrones, this is one of the options. It's a variant. Whereas I see with Damon, he's looking at her. They're all operating as if she's the queen. He choked the queen.
Yeah, he certainly did. Fran, you got an opinion on this?
You know, I actually, my gut says Otto, and namely because who has the power to bench said offender? And I think obviously it's Rhaenyra and it's Allison. And Allison has already done plenty to combat what her father has been trying to do, and trying to essentially take hold of that power and use it for himself and really kind of take control of the situation. Whereas with Rhaenyra, and this is not excusing what Damon did, obviously, but coming out immediately out of that, the smile, the realization on her face, you could almost get that sense, number one, that was not the first time that there was that kind of interaction between those two. But also number two, I think there was almost, and this is kind of getting into the scene itself, there was almost like a validation for Rhaenyra in that moment of like, yeah, like my father never told you. And that validates like why I should feel the way I do. We should not be the aggressors here. We should be taking it. He never told you because you were this hothead. Right. And then to me, like, I kind of look at that as not necessarily that she pities him, but a little bit in that area. Right. Where it's not like she did not fight and combat him immediately coming out of that. And so I think it's more likely that Allison is going to try and do more to overstep her father as opposed to Rhaenyra trying to put the kibosh on Damon.
So yeah, Damon kind of, when he resorts to physical violence, it's almost a concession that I'm out of words.
Yeah.
Like you clearly know more, you have better things to say, you've won the argument, I'm going to resort to the other avenue. For Allison, I kind of feel like there's a little bit of a GM versus ownership issue. It's like, who's got the power? Allison used to have the power because the ownership group was sort of hands off. But now that her son's on the throne, it's kind of like having a new owner, the owner of a new team, who's like, is this going to be a hands off owner, or is this owner is going to let the GM do his job? So I don't know if Allison certainly was kind of running the kingdom. I think it kind of remains to be seen now that Aegon's on the throne, who is actually running the show. Who would have the power to can Otto if indeed you wanted to can Otto?
Well, I think, I look at it, the analogy, I'll go a little different, and I'll say that Aegon is the new star player, the free agent that you just picked up. He's going to choose who's coaching.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so he's Kevin Durant deciding to oust.
Allison has a chance. But maybe as the GM, but again, if Otto's the coach, it depends on who's going to be in the ear first, right? And we had a whole episode about let's get to the ear before anyone else does, as if that ear can only be talked to now.
All right.
So, it's like a race to see which limo can pick him up from the airport first when he gets into town.
Exactly. Yeah.
Rookie of the Year honors. I'm going to give you a few options. You can go a different direction if you want. Here are the options. Amund, Helena, or Jace, Rookie of the Year honors. Steve, you got an opinion on this?
I mean, I got to go with Amund. I mean, sometimes it's a little sloppy, but I mean, you want to just talk about raw talent.
It's odd to think of a rookie having an eye patch. It's a little, you think Normally, eye patches go to grizzled veterans.
Well, he's one of those rookies, you know, where it's like he's clearly an international rookie because you're like, yeah, I mean, he's supposed to be a certain age, but I got to check that birth certificate.
Sure. He's a Cuban pitcher.
That's right.
All right. All right. So, Amond, and then, of course, Fran, yours is Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, I think it would have to be Amond, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit, but it just felt like every scene that he was in, I was just captivated by him. And there's so many similarities between he and Damon as in terms of their presence, not just with the job by the actors, but just the characters in general. I think I got to go Amond, and not just for the impact he can make on screen, but also things he does when he's not even speaking. I would say it would be Amond.
So I was impressed with Jace this last episode. You know, you stand up to Damon. That's kind of a big deal, right?
Sure.
So but as soon as Amond took off the eye patch and revealed the sapphire eye, that was it.
Yep.
I want my Rookie of the Year to be a showman. I want to be able to market this league, and that's what I want out of my rookie. I want a sapphire eyeball.
Yeah, and it's really going to set the tone, right? I mean, because now that he's got sponsorship from the Sapphire Eye Company.
sponsorship from Tarth. All right, so we're going to go to Comeback Player of the Year. I'll give you a few options. You can, of course, choose someone that's not on my list. Fran will ask you first. Comeback Player of the Year, Renice or Corliss?
I mean, so Corliss obviously makes a miraculous recovery from what was seemed to be a lethal injury from one episode earlier.
Counted out as dead.
Yeah, I mean, his brother lost his life over the fact that the idea that his brother was going to die. But I think if I'm going to look at it like first five episodes versus second five episodes, I found myself very much in the camp of Rhaenys in the final five, especially in those last couple of episodes. And, you know, the dynamic that she has, not just with Rhaenyra, but also I loved that conversation that she had with Alicent as well when she was being held captive. Obviously, the scene that everybody talked about at the end of the penultimate was good in its own right. But I think those discussions that she has had, and I loved the reunion between her and Corliss also really stood out to me in the finale. To me, I think looking at Rhaenys, the depth of her character and how we've seen her always trying to nudge Corliss the right way. And right when it seems like, oh, well, Corliss is like, yeah, you know what? You're right the whole time. We should have been sitting on the sidelines. We shouldn't have been so aggressive. He's like, no, you fool. Like, this is where we have to be aggressive. She is the one certainly kind of steering that ship. And so Rhaenys, I think, really would be the comeback player for me.
All right, Steve, your comeback player of the year.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of following the same path that Fran is here. I mean, like, you look at it, you look at what Corliss did. I mean, coming back from that major injury, everybody thought that maybe it was a career ender. But, you know, and you watch him on the court, and you're like, you know, he's playing, but, I mean, he's a shell of himself, and who knows? Maybe we're probably another season away of knowing if this guy's ever going to be able to be the two-way player we thought he could be. And I think Rhaenys is really the one who's just, she's carrying him up and down the court because she's had an opportunity, right? I mean, that's the thing is when somebody's, you know, when the bench gets depleted and somebody gets the chance to step up and maybe show their skill set that they didn't have before, I think Rhaenys is clearly the comeback player of the year. I mean, you may even make the argument, some can make the argument that she just isn't so much, she was maybe sixth man, but now it wasn't so much that she was a comeback player. She just didn't have the opportunity to start.
So I like this, and I think I was going to say Rhaenys, but it just occurred to me that another name should be on this list, and that is Otto. At the end of episode 5, Otto had been demoted. He wasn't even in the city anymore. Now he's got his grandson on the Iron Throne. I think maybe, just for the sake of zigging where you guys zagged, I'll go with Otto as comeback player of the year. Finally, dismemberment of the year. Okay, I give you a few options for dismemberment of the year. The first episode, a guy in Fleabottom gets gelded.
Yep.
That was a very graphic dismemberment. Option two, Crab Feeder loses his bottom half. All right, that's a big one. Amond loses an eye. Vaemond loses half a head. Or Luke loses a torso. So what is your Steve, what is your dismemberment of the year?
Yes, it's this is where it's about I mean, there's the gruesome factor. There's, I think, the level of importance.
Oh, yeah, the impact on the story, for sure.
Yeah, and so, to me, the crab feeder one gets, to me, that I don't need it, you know.
And we didn't see it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. So, for all we know, it could have been self-inflicted.
he was holding the wrong side of the sword.
he tripped over a copier, you know.
The crabs turned on him.
Yeah, exactly. Damon's like, oh, well, now I found it. That's the big reveal in the next season. I never even touched the crab feeder.
You'd never know. He never talks about anything.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, like, you know, hey, look, a guy getting gelded, look, that, I mean, it had an impact on me initially, but I mean, who was that guy, right? And so I'm going to go Aemon's Eye, because I think it's symbolic.
Really?
It's I think it makes it, huh. I mean, I think it sets a path, right?
I almost didn't even include it on the list, but I certainly like where you're going with this. The narrative impact is certainly.
Yeah, the narrative impact. If you even go back to, like you said, just the sheer pageantry that now goes along with it. I mean, good grief. I mean, I know that, like, it's going to feel like after like 7 reveals of the eye, we're going to be like, okay, we get it to Sapphire Eye, but I'll probably be tuning in every time. Like, I want every penultimate episode to have an eye reveal. Like, maybe it changes color.
Maybe it did, you know? Totally different.
I love the idea that it's like a mood eye.
Well, now that we know that he's getting sponsorship, I would expect a little T for Tarth on there.
Yeah, he's got a little Rakuten eye. And he's gonna...
All right, dismemberment of the year, Fran.
I got to go with the shock factor of Vaemond. You know, you knew once he said that it was about, it was going down, but, and even, you know, Damon saying like, say it, it, but just the way with which it happened and the shock factor, I think it's gotta be Vaemond losing half of his head. That's on the Joe Theismann scale of, just gruesome injuries that you witness in person. You know, I think that certainly maybe doesn't have like quite the narrative impact, of Aemon losing his eye, but I think that's probably the one that just like catches you most off screen.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking.
I don't know if you realize they actually say, like, if it's in the background and it's in Old Valyrian, but if it translates to finish him.
I'm gonna go with Luke loses a torso. I feel like I was really impacted by the season finale and that final chomp, and you're just seeing those arms and legs falling into the clouds. I thought that was amazing. It sets up the second season. Yep. So
you get the visual and you get the narrative impact there for both ends.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make. Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time. Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret, Hush Hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers. Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited. It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live. Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday. Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Okay, now let's do MVPs. Now, I will start with your power rankings last time we met. And, Steve, your power rankings from first to fifth were Otto, Laris, Alicent, Daemon, and Rhaenyra. Mm-hmm. I just want to note, you had three Team Green members at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the fact that kind of the Team Green seems to have the upper hand at this point, I think it probably justifies this list pretty well. But I'm wondering, who do you place as the season MVP?
That's a good question. I mean, I had in the power rankings, what, Otto was number one.
Otto was number one, Laris number two, Alicent three, Daemon four, Rhaenyra five.
Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of the overall season, I mean, we're talking, okay, this is why, you know, MVP discussions are so important, right? I mean,
yeah, we don't want the best player. We want the player who's most valuable to their respective team.
Right? Yeah. Then in that case, I think I'm going to stick with Otto in this particular case.
Wow.
I mean, let's just look at the way you distilled it a little bit ago. I mean, he's got his grandson on the throne, right? Possession mm-hmm. is 9/10. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, anything that anybody's doing is actually to attack and usurp that which has already been recognized now. And the coronation has happened. So everything now is essentially treasonous.
Yeah.
Right?
Also, Aegon's relationship with his mother is pretty fraught.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think you often see teenage boys push away from their mothers and at a certain stage of their life. I don't know that he has much of a relationship at all with his grandfather, and I think that that might actually help Otto kind of come in. He's got that older male voice in a very patriarchal society. I think Otto's situated pretty well.
Yeah, again, having that voice, having the history of being the hand, all of those things are so you don't have to even see him. Like, even if you had like a relationship that was a little bit more standoffish with your grandfather, mm-hmm. this relationship isn't even that anymore, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this is wise counsel, and yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think the fraught relationship with his mother is going to make it so that he's much more susceptible to listen to somebody who is a man, who has been in charge, mm-hmm. And especially was kind of like he was proxy in charge while, you know, his own father was essentially, you know, rotten away.
Okay, so Fran, let's look at your power rankings. At midseason, you had Alicent number one. That's a pretty decent choice. Laris number two, Corlys number three, Daemon four, and Rhaenyra five. I would say aside from Corlys, this is a pretty solid starting five. We almost kind of lost track of Corlys for a while, but having Alicent at the top was a pretty strong choice. Now that you've seen the full season, who's your MVP?
You know, I thought about this, and I think I'm going to have to bump Alicent from 1 to 2, and I'm going to have a big riser here because I really feel that. And my big question with Rhaenyra in the first 5 episodes was how willing was she to be able to play the Game of Thrones, right? To be able to play that politics game. And I think we saw a much more tempered version of Rhaenyra in the final 5 episodes of the season. Someone who was willing to not just, you know, fire and blood everything or just completely ignore everything that you know, that entire side of the battle.
She's all grown up, that one.
Yeah, I think that was a huge transformation that, you know, you could question whether or not it was a little too abrupt, you know, from one side to the other. But now that we have seen that over these last 5 episodes, I think that to me really kind of stood out. And so I actually would have Rhaenyra at number 1 now, with Allison at number 2. And MVP. I think that, yeah, I think for me, Rhaenyra, and this could be, maybe it is an Emma D'Arcy thing as well. I think that she was awesome in these final 5 episodes. But to me, I would say that Rhaenyra would be my MVP now.
Wow. Okay, my starting 5 for my power ranking went from Rhaenyra number 1, Lionel number 2. That was a big miss. It was my draft day bust. Lionel gets killed the next episode.
That pick went up in flames. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you got it. Allison 3, Daemon 4, Aegon 5. I was the only one with Aegon on the list. Otherwise, this list is not good. this is pretty bad. Pretty bad. MVP of this, I think I got to go Rhaenyra just because I feel like she's set up to really wreak some havoc season 2. Even though she's not on the throne.
Right, this is why you guys shouldn't have your MVP votes, right? We're going to start giving people most valuable potential now? Come on, guys. I'm talking about this season. What have you done?
You go throughout the entire season. Who's the biggest case for the main character of the show? I would probably say Viserys until the last 2 episodes, and then Rhaenyra really takes over. So I think that Rhaenyra is well placed as the main character of the show.
So you're saying Viserys was the MVP, but then he had that season ending injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe I'm putting Rhaenyra as the finals MVP. And maybe that's what my problem is, that I'm letting the playoff performance influence a regular season job. All right. I'm going to change this. Viserys is my MVP and Rhaenyra is my finals MVP.
If I remember right, the 3 of us agreed that Viserys was the MVP of the first 5 episodes. So I think that tracks.
Yeah, I don't even know how you give the, so you're giving the finals MVP to the losing team. That's a bold move by Jerry West.
There you go. Well, I did grow up a Warriors fan. I'm very well acquainted with losing. I have some trade scenarios for you. I want to hear now. Steve, this is for you. Let's say you're the GM for Team Green. Okay. Mm-hmm. You get Rhaenys and her dragon, or, and here's what you would have to give up in return: Helaena, her dragon, and her prophetic ability. So Rhaenys for Helaena. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not making that move. I mean, am I getting Helaena and her prophetic ability?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The thing that we consistently go, oh, look, she predicted that. to me, it's...
Oh, you mean, do you understand anything she's saying?
Right, exactly. So
it's like some coaches don't know what they have. Some coaches, they've got Andrew Wiggins, but they don't know how to get anything out of him, right?
Right. Now, that makes a lot of sense, yeah. You're saying that Helaena is, you know, if people would just listen to her gibberish every once in a while.
Now, you're Team Green here at this point, right?
You're getting Rhaenys, yeah.
So you'd be getting Rhaenys.
I'd be getting Rhaenys.
It could be that you don't really understand what the value that Helaena has, but if you did, what would you choose?
I'm gonna go with Rhaenys, right? I'm trying to win now. And I feel like she's
ready to go.
She's ready to go. Like, you know, as great as it would be. If I'm in a rebuilding year, you know, if I'm trying to get that, then by all means, give me give me somebody who's a little out of the box and that I could actually like mm-hmm. again, I would get someone that we'd probably bring in like an assistant that only specializes in trying to figure out what the hell she's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fran, you're a GM for Team Green. You get you get offered the following trade. Damon for Amund.
Whoa.
Yeah. I think I'm going to say no to that deal.
Is it youth? Youth?
Yeah, because of youth. But actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I think that Damon, I mean, we already know he controls one dragon and potentially based off that finale control, it might control two and one that is apparently just as big or close to the same size as Vhagar. Whereas Amund, as we see, does not have control.
Yeah, yeah.
Of Vhagar. So
interesting.
But I think the youth might win out. If I'm a general manager, I typically have the long term, the long view in mind. So, mm-hmm. so I think I might take that. I also would take the Rhaenys deal as well. I would take Rhaenys because I feel like she could be a booster for Alicent in terms of being able to bring out the best in her kind of elevate her forward as well.
I love it. All right.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, too, about the Amund versus Damon thing. Because I think you could even go further and say, okay, look, yeah, he may have two dragons or more.
Yep.
But the question is, did Amund not have control of the dragon? Or are we in a situation where we realize that maybe nobody has as much control over the dragons as we thought? Mm. So maybe there's actually, it's not in Damon's best interest to have multiple dragons if he doesn't have. Like, if you have like less control over multiple dragons, like they say, you have no dragons.
Okay. All right, this is another one for you, Fran. You are the GM of Team Black.
Okay.
Would you trade Corlys and all of his ships for Larys and a Book of Matches?
No, I think I would keep Corlys. I think I would keep Corlys and the ships. And look, we don't know what the long-term viability is of Corlys, but I think that having that fleet is just of so much importance for Team Black right now. I'm assuming, well, I guess I shouldn't make that assumption, but that Rhaenys and Corlys would be a package deal. But I do think that if you're able to keep Corlys and those ships, you control obviously all of that Blackwater Bay and all of the trade that goes in and out. Corlys has been saying incessantly, you control the step zones and you can control all the trade going in and out of King's Landing. And so I think that is such an important part of the siege and the war to come.
Okay, now if it wasn't a Book of Matches, it was a bottle of Wildfire. would you take Larys then?
Yeah, so something to combat those ships reflect back on the Battle of the Blackwater. I might.
Don't do it, dude. Don't do it, dude.
Yeah, I might, but I think I'm going to stand strong. I think I'm going to stand strong there with Corlys.
Larys is the Kyrie Irving of this world right now, okay? I don't care what else he might be bringing to the table. He is
untouchable.
He's radioactive, as the GMs are saying. Yeah.
All right, Steve, last one. This is for you. You're the GM for Team Black. You can either have Damon's murder cloak or a bowl of maggots. What do you want? Damon's murder cloak or a bowl of maggots?
Man, that bowl of maggots goes a long way. I mean, I thought Viserys was going to die an awful lot of times, but you know, soaks in it like a bowl of palm olive.
It's like it's like an ice bath after a game.
Exactly. Just picture Jordan got a couple of bowls of maggots on his knees.
That's how he got through the flu game.
Exactly.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Brendan Walsh, I'm curious what we might say about religion in Martin's world, and you're a religion and history specialist, and I was hoping that maybe to talk a little bit about A Clash of Kings, but maybe we begin more generally with your area of research.
Actually, one question before you go. This is a weird one.
Okay.
But whenever you do your bird's eye view section, there's a sound bite you use, and I'm always so curious what that sound bite is. It sounds like a rock being rolled out of the way or something. Is that what it is?
This is good. Okay. I think what it is I was looking for like online free audio, like just open source audio that anyone can use when I first started the podcast. And I think I might have put into the engine Stone Door.
Okay.
For some reason, I thought of it as like, it's like there's this magical door in the wall. Like, I don't know if you remember this. When Sam's coming back through the wall, like he said, he repeats the oath of the Night's Watch. And it's like the mouth of this face opens into a door. And I thought, that must make sort of a stone-on-stone sound. We didn't get to see it in the show. And I thought, it's a really cool idea. I really missed it. I really didn't get to see it in the show. And I thought, I would love to grab a sound that I associate with that stone, that magical stone door opening. And I think that's what I did. I just went into the search engine of the free website and put in Stone Door.
and he got that.
And I got. And I've used it. I've used it for 3 years now.
But I'm always confused how that connects to Bird's Eye View. Like the name and the sound bite just don't gel for me. No.
Well, I think that's a good question. You're jogging my memory like this. I think that Bird's Eye View was one of the subheadings that Aaron and I used in our book, Gods of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I think that subtitle was something like metacriticism, which is a very sort of academic term that we wanted to put at the end of every chapter to talk more of the metacritical issues, you know, like, you know, is Danny a white savior figure or something? And eventually I just thought, who am I writing this book for? This is not a book for academics. This is a book for people who are super interested in this world that Martin's created. And so I thought Bird's Eye View is a better concept. So yeah, there's no relationship to a bird and a stone door.
Okay.
So yeah, that's any other sound effects questions, Brendan?
No, that was the one pressing one. And it's something that comes to mind every time I hear it. So I'm glad I was able to get on the pod for the sole reason to ask this question.
All right. So, yeah, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts on House of the Dragon, if you've been watching House of the Dragon.
I have. I'm up to date. It's great so far. I'm really enjoying it.
You like it so far?
Yeah, I think it's returned to form for the whole series.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so have you noticed, I mean, there are a couple religious elements to this show, but I don't feel like I've learned a whole lot more about Targaryen religion in this show.
No, that's something that is lacking. In House of the Dragon, we are strangely devoid of information about the Targaryens, because I know in old Valyria, they had their own gods, own worship of gods. But as soon as the Targaryens left, they seem to have, sort of turned themselves into gods in this new land that they came to.
Now, one thing that you could say is that prophetic oracles tend to come from a stance of faith, right?
Yes.
And this show definitely leaned into the prophetic aspect of the Targaryens, in that some Targaryens are thought to be dreamers. So this seems to be a primary motivation for Viserys. So at least we have that bit of window into, you know, not only are the families out of old Valyria motivated at times, and sometimes quite convincingly, by their prophecies, the prophecy continues to motivate Viserys even into the present. And I think that there's something about that that is an outworking of faith. How do you see that?
Well, the thing with prophecy in a Game of Thrones universe, I think it does happen a lot. Like every character, or not, like all the main characters seem to have some touch of prophecy to them, and it's not sort of reliant on any one faith. This is the one sort of shared power that all faiths, all people seem to possess, particularly in the Game of Thrones world. But yeah, there is something special about Targaryens. Their form of prophecy is directly tied to the fate of Westeros, so beyond that. But yeah, there is something special about their prophecy, because I guess it's connected to their bloodline.
You almost see that something of a parallel here with the ancient Egyptians. Like, they're connected to the supernatural, and it's almost as if the pharaoh represents the deity. You almost get the sense that these Targaryens put forth that particular political view to their own advantage. But of course, when you get them talking amongst themselves, they kind of know that that's not true.
Prophecy is a part of their statecraft, essentially.
I guess another way that you could look at it is that, like, Daemon Targaryen is like a true believer. Like, he really does believe, you know, the doctrine of exceptionalism. He really does believe, I'm a species apart. I'm actually a higher form of life. I'm the dragon, and everyone else in this kingdom is my prey. He kind of acts that way. You know, he almost does not respect anyone who isn't a Targaryen or isn't from old Valyria. So I wonder if there's something to be said about Damon's primary motivation, because he is so invested in the traditions of Old Valyria.
Yeah, that is a good question. Yeah, you're right. He does see himself as apart from the rest of the world. And I think because of that, he's able to, you know, to commit these terrible deeds, knowing that he's in the right. Like, this is for the greater good. He is immune to the laws of the land, which is... This is a big sticking point between the Faith of Seven and Targaryens. Faith of Seven is really, they're trying to, push their own morality and own ethics upon the Targaryens. But we see with Daemon that he is, and other members of Targaryens who marry their siblings and commit incest, that they sort of have this, disregard for the laws of Westeros and like to perform in their own way.
Yeah, okay, so that's interesting. So... I feel like I'd love to get right into A Clash of Kings with you, because
yeah, sure.
We are introduced to Melisandre in this prologue. She brings a unique window into monotheism, which we really haven't seen a lot in Martin's world yet. So you almost start to see a little bit of a clash in religions, whereas in the previous book it was a little bit more synchronistic between the old gods and the new. It was almost sort of like, there were some sort of cultural clashes, but nothing like we see with Melisandre. So I'm curious.
No, you're right. You're exactly right. Yeah.
I'm curious what you might say about her as a representative of either ancient concepts or early modern concepts.
Well, okay. I think what Melisandre represents is sort of a Eastern esoteric sort of religion creeping into the world, and particularly when in contrast with the Faith of Seven, which is very, Catholic in general. It's very clear mm-hmm. that George Martin has modeled Faith of Seven on the medieval Catholic Church. And in the prologue in particular, we see that the Faith of Seven is in direct contrast to the powers of Melisandre and her red religion.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, we see Maester Crezan. He in the prologue, there's a whole section where he's trying to poison Melisandre because
yeah.
he sees her as a threat to Stannis, and she's able to overcome that poison with sort of powers beyond his reckoning.
Yeah, beyond his study year.
Yeah, exactly. So he has faith that this is the right course to take, and he is tending to take them both out. And I think in this case, we see that he's using poison, which is a really, material, worldly approach to deal with something, while she is using these powers, these spiritual powers. Whatever she, in a prologue, it says that the gem on her neck starts to glow when she drinks the poison, and she's able to somehow through that be immune to its powers.
My sense is that the Faith of the Seven represents, yes, indeed, the medieval Catholic Church, but my sense is that it represents Roman religion more generally. And the reason why I would say that is that Rome was thought of, the city on seven hills. That's kind of how Rome was thought in the ancient world. It was the city with seven hills. And, of course, what we have with the Faith of Seven is something of sort of an Andal tradition that comes over to Westeros. So you see that kind of interest in the number seven come over with the Andals. It's almost like the Romans are coming to England, in a sense. And, of course, that does somewhat parallel the spread of Christianity, but not in the early stages. And so I wonder if the Faith of the Seven is a bit more broad than just Catholicism.
Yeah, I would say it sort of resembles the Roman Empire during its much later periods, as it had become a Christian, and also as it was invaded by the Goths. So, during the 5th century, the Visigoths came to Rome and they invaded it and they sacked Rome itself. But then they were sort of converted when they sacked Rome. So I think you can make a comparison to the Targaryens and the invading Visigoths, because we see the Targaryens come and they they sort of fuse their beliefs with the Seven, use that facade to rule across the kingdoms.
Right. Oh, yeah. So when Mel comes to Dragonstone, she brings this new faith with her, and she also brings prophecy with her. And
yes.
From a more, I guess we could say, a xenophobic perspective, her god represents some kind of demon. And I think we see that mentioned several times by people who are unsure of Mel and what she provides. And we kind of see that. You talked a little bit about, you know, the use of demonology to demonize, you know, literally demonize, you know, someone's religious rival. And I think this is exactly what we're seeing with Melisandre.
Yeah, exactly. No, like, as you see from the prologue, with the Maester, he's clearly labeling her as a witch or invoking the image of a witch. And if we go back to our demonology, sort of, if you were a witch, you had sort of signed a contract with the devil, and then in return, the devil would give you sort of powers and abilities beyond a normal person. So in this case, we have the Maester confronting someone who's made a demonic pact with a god of some sorts, and he is, you know, he's powerless before her.
Right. So Crescent, of course, wagers, and he bets wrong, and he dies.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what Mel is going to require, and this isn't always the case with missionaries, and in fact, I think it's almost rarely the case with missionaries, but she almost spreads her religion. I mean, she's like riding a political horse. It's interesting that she's chosen Stannis as her horse that she's going to ride to spread her religion. Or is it possible that she's not interested in really spreading the whole thing? She just really believes the prophecy. So she really is going to get behind Stannis and take that as far as it needs to go.
I think she is content with Stannis. She thinks she's in a great position of power. And she believes that he is the one in the prophecy. So through him, she can achieve her means.
Right. And then we have this parallel with her and Thoros, right?
Yes.
If you think back to what his original mission was, it was to convert Robert. And of course, it's Robert ends up converting Thoros, I think, in the end. Because Thoros goes from priest to hedonist.
Yes, exactly.
Rather than Robert going from hedonist to, you know, adherent of the Red God or whatever. It's almost like R'hllor worship has this system of proselytization where you're almost supposed to begin with the king. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like, hey, if we can convert Constantine, then we can actually change the entire religion of the entire country. Which, you know, I don't know if that has worked many times in history, but it did end up working for Constantine, right? So
no, that's right. Yeah, no, I think their strategy of going to like the leader and trying for a top down approach is the right one, and it works some of the times. With Stannis, we know that his house does convert. His wife is a big believer as well, and I think, you know, if Stannis had actually managed to conquer Westeros and become a king, maybe it would have been more successful. Maybe the religion would flourish, but. You know, it all rides on him succeeding. So, and this is the case.
I think she's pretty sure of herself. I mean, early on when we meet her, you know, the show's a little bit different in the later seasons, but it feels like she's pretty certain that Stannis is going to be the horse that wins the race. What's interesting to me is not only does R'hllor worship come into conflict with the faith of the Seven, but then in the latter books, we see Stannis go up to defend the wall. And then we see kind of R'hllor religion to interface with. I mean, I guess you could almost call the Night's Watch something of a religious community. It's just that the wall is kind of the deity in that system. But then, of course, then you're dealing with the old gods as well.
Yeah, I suppose you can make a comparison with the Night's Watch and the Templars, and their sort of mission is to defend the realm.
Yeah, I had a guest on who was talking a little bit about the way that monotheism is represented in Martin's world. And of course, there are other monotheisms, you know, lurking, you know, like the drowned god and whatnot.
Yeah.
This guy, Jason Eberle, he basically said there's something that monotheism brings to the table in this world that other religions don't. And it's almost this, because it is monotheism, there's almost an exclusivity you don't find in the other religions. Because they are more polytheistic, they're generally going to be open to the idea that a different culture has a different god, and that's legitimate for them.
Yeah, I agree, because with Faith of Seven, for some reason, it is tolerant of other religions, particularly in Westeros. Like, it's like it doesn't go out and try to suppress the old gods or worship of the old gods. I think it's tolerant of the Rhoynar and Dorne. And I think it is, from a historical perspective, these sort of polytheistic religions, they do have a place to accept other gods, because they themselves have a pantheon of gods. So it makes more sense that they would recognize gods in other places. Like with Rome, they had their pantheon, but at the same time, they understood that there was gods in other lands that other people worshipped. But as we see from Rome converting to a Christian outlook, because there was only one god, and that sort of dismisses all other claims to faith in other lands and religion itself.
Even though there generally is something of a tolerance, historically speaking, you know, these religions did clash. Like, for instance, you know, the Faith of the Seven is not super excited about Targaryens marrying brother to sister, and so they clash a bit with that. And the Faith of the Seven ends up coming up with this doctrine of exceptionalism, where they're like, well, the Targaryens are something of a different species, and so they have different rules.
Exactly.
And then, of course, the Andals do end up cutting down a lot of the weirwood trees in the south, or most of the weirwood trees in the south. So you do see something of a clash early on, but then over time, eventually there comes some kind of equilibrium.
In terms of structure and appearance, I think the Faith of Seven is clearly medieval Catholicism, but in the sort of the sort of religion being practiced is probably from a much later date, like probably 18th or 19th century. We see it's a lot more modernized in how it's practiced. It is, for one, it's very tolerant of other religions. Two, is not such a resort to esoteric sort of performances of devotion. It's a lot more secularized point of worship within the Faith of Seven.
Yeah, and even you have with the High Sparrow later on, you have something of a, I don't know if I would exactly call it a reformation, but there's almost a Protestant Catholic split with the High Sparrow.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So that would certainly be early modern.
For sure.
Now, the other major storyline that we meet in A Clash of Kings is the business beyond the wall. And we see that Craster is some kind of adherent to the White Walkers. He almost views himself as offering human sacrifices to the White Walkers. And of course, Jon Snow discovers this, and there's some question about like what is Craster actually think he's doing? I'm not sure if this is in the books, but at one point in the show, he's like, you know, he's being confronted, and he says, "I'm a godly man," and I wonder what he means by that. And the only thing that I can think that he thinks he means is that he is an adherent to these gods beyond the wall. And so he's got some kind of covenant with them. But I wonder, it's an interesting question for religion, because I think the general thought is that there are no real gods in Martin's world. But if you think of the Targaryens as kind of Greek gods, and the creatures beyond the wall is kind of Jotunheim or something. You almost do have these deities that they just don't look in the way that, you know, modern people think deities look.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think Martin has gone on record in interviews saying that, you know, perhaps there's no real gods, but they're just underlying all this is a general sense of magic that every religion has their own interpretation of. So it's not really there's different gods. It's more like there's sort of a spiritual force in the universe that manifests in different ways in different locations to different people. And with Craster, I guess that he's following a very old way that's, you know, that's outside the faith of the Andals. I think in particular he's worshiping gods or deities that have direct power. He's able to, you know,
yeah, you know, whether or not they're actually deities is kind of secondary. It's that Craster thinks that they are and treats them as if they are.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it goes to a much greater point about the religion Game of Thrones, because we see with the Faith of Seven, there's no real, you know, displays of spiritual power like attributed to the Septons or anyone connected to the Faith of Seven. But as we go further outside of old Westeros and see in later books that there's religions with power attached, like, you know, like the old gods and the Red Priest and, you know, and Jack and Hagar and his religion. Like, there is power in this world and power connected to religions, but just not with the Faith of the Seven.
Yeah,
and
right.
And from a historical point of view, like, sort of the best way to demonstrate the anyone validity of a religion is through displays of power. If you go back to the Bible, we see with Christ and his disciples, a key way that they showed that, like, the validity of their faith was to perform like these miraculous deeds. They have Jesus is healing people, he's expelling demons, he is walking on water, performing all these great deeds, and this is how he and his disciples showed that they are the real deal. But when it comes to the Faith of Seven, we see no sort of spiritual gifts attached to that religion at all.
Yeah, I think that I've seen this from time to time online, is like, you know, people ask, well, why would anyone follow the Faith of the Seven if it's the one religion that doesn't have any kind of magic behind it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I've always said, oh no, that's exactly the religion I would follow, because I don't want to be anywhere near someone like Melisandre. That would freak me out. I would, if I'm around Craster, nope, I don't want any part of that. The Faceless Men, you guys are basically assassins. Not interested. Drown God, no. I think I'm okay. Don't want to be baptized. I want a priest who is there to marry my sons and daughters when it comes time. I want them to give a good funeral, and I want to go about my daily life. And I almost think that that's the religion in Martin's world that provides the social dynamics of the rituals that provide a pattern for the people of Westeros. In other words, I would say that it's the one thing in Martin's world that is especially religious, because it's almost like the religion of the old gods is a little bit loosey-goosey. You know, there are rituals, but they're not nearly as developed as the rituals around the Faith of the Seven.
No, you're exactly right. No, I think the whole point of Faith of Seven is to provide a contrast with the other sort of marauding actual forces on the borders of Westeros. And as we see at the end of book one with Dany and sort of her dragons being released from the eggs, that sort of signals the release of magic into the world. And over the next few books, we see that the magic is coming to Westeros. Like, the world is coming re-enchanted in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, these forces are coming on to the land of Westeros, and people are beginning to see things they haven't seen in thousands of years.
Right. I think the other important aspect of the Faith of the Seven, and I think that we'll probably see that more maybe toward the latter half of A Clash of Kings, is that it's a very useful religion for political machinations.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
If you want to, you could say something like, you know, what should we do with this traitor? Well, I think the father's just. We need justice, you know. Or if you wanted to, you know, let the person off the hook, you could say, you know, the mother provides mercy. I think we should let this person off the hook. So it's almost like the seven faces of God are a way to brand whatever political choice you feel like is most advantageous to you as the Lord of the Kingdom. That's my sense of it.
No, I agree. Like, sort of, this is, as Martin describes it, we see that religion and politics are fully infused in Whitworth-Strauss. And their sort of code of ethics is totally, it's developed from their faith. So we see that as practiced by rulers, they take their laws are influenced by how their faith is practiced and how it's laid down by a septon. So I guess in comparison to other religions in Game of Thrones, we sort of see that the king and the high sparrow or the high septon, whoever's the top of the church, are really hand in glove. That they're using each other to the best benefits, and they're in tandem.
No, I think that that's the design of it. I think that if the kingdom is functioning smoothly, you've got the high septon rubber stamping everything that the king does, and the king in turn doesn't do anything that's kind of upset the religion of the folks in the kingdom.
Yeah, for sure. And this also connects to like sort of a big theory about the role of the Citadel and the Maesters in Martin's world. There is this idea that that they are sort of the ones pulling the strings behind the Faith of the Seven, and they are promoting a religion that downplays magic and all these other sort of spiritual forces for their own means.
Yeah, and I've just outed myself as someone who's say pro Maester in this way.
You promised, okay.
I want less magic. I don't like what dragons do. I don't want my entrails hung from the branches of a tree. I don't want assassins running around with no checks and balances. No, but you're right. There is sort of a prominent fan theory that has the Maesters using the Faith of the Seven as a tool in the same way I guess I've just described as... You know, that the religion has been used as a tool by the kings as well. But I guess the fan theory, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Faith of the Seven is actually invented by the Maesters. And if that's the case, the whole mythology of the Andals is just fabricated.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm quite sure there's different interpretations. There's like this more extremist view of this theory and a more average view, like. But yes, like the Mokshim issue is that that whole mythology is invented for the purposes of keeping the populace in check.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Sort of an opiate of the masses kind of view on religion, which, you know, we will see. I mean, I guess, you know, I myself as a man of faith think that we are going to get Winds of Winter. And
yes, I think so as well. It's coming.
Yes. And then, of course, I think we'll also see developed in that book something that's introduced more robustly in Clash of Kings, and that is the Ironborn faith, right? So we see the whole Pike, I guess you'd call it the culture of the Ironborn in this book. And then, of course, we'll learn of what was his name, Aaron Damphair.
Yeah, I think that's
who's a prophet, and sort of a more like a prophet with a political point of view. And so it's interesting that we have that religion come to the fore in this book, because I think that that's what a lot of people are expecting from Winds, that we will get to see a little bit more of the sort of Lovecraftian religiosity. See some of these deep ones come to the fore.
Yeah, I think the most exciting thing about Clash of Kings, remember when first reading it, is like the whole world really opens up. Like you see all these different religions introduced, see all these different cultures come into play, and we see a lot more pieces on the chessboard that come into play.
Yeah. You know, you're going to see the whole business about Bran going north, and then, of course, we meet, you know, sort of the one of the real magical players in the universe. And that connects, my sense is that Three-Eyed Crow connects very deeply with, you know, the religion of the old gods.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question about that. What is the relationship between the religion of the old gods and the magic of the White Walkers, in your view? Are these two distinctly different things, or like, does one come out of the other? You know, we got a little bit of an answer in the show, but it seems like the books are going a different direction with all of that.
Yeah, I actually had no real idea. So if I recall correctly, the show says that the White Walkers were created by the Children of the Forest. Is that right?
Yeah, so yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's like they created a weapon.
Yeah.
And then the weapon turned against them or something like that, which is an interesting idea for sure. But it's clear to me that Craster is offering his baby specifically to the others. The Children of the Forest, Three-Eyed Crow, is set in antithesis to the others.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The whole sacrificing Craster does suggest that there is sort of a system of religion already in place. And if the Children of the Forest had created the White Walkers, then it's unlikely that they would have their own sort of mythology themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because in some of the deepest lore, we have the sense that the Children of the Forest have their own system of worship.
Yeah.
And you know, they look to these tree spirits as gods. So it's interesting. I'm not sure where that overlap is between what Craster thinks he's worshiping and what the Children of the Forest think that they're worshiping, and how the Three-Eyed Crow relates to these things. I mean, one way that you could look at it is that, like, Three-Eyed Crow is part and parcel with sort of northern ice magic,
yeah,
but is just in a political struggle with the White Walkers.
Interesting view. Well, I guess it depends. I guess you could say with the White Walkers or the others that they're sort of born in a cold climate. So they're very in tune with the natural world, which is, you know, ice all around them. So I guess it makes sense that their religion would develop into something that reflects their location where they were born, where they grew up. So it might be, in fact, sort of the same religion, but just practice in different ways.
Yeah, the analog here would be like the High Sparrow. It's like the High Sparrow and Circe are on the surface both adherents of the Faith of the Seven, right? But they're locked in this political struggle, and both you know, appealing to a different authority to make their struggle, to give their struggle credence. And so then the question is there something similar happening with the White Walkers and the Children of the Forest? I mean, that to me, that's the real interesting thing about how this series will end, because it seems to me the big baddie is not the person who sits on the Iron Throne, but the person who's invading from the north. And of course, you know, we're eventually going to see ice and fire meet. And it seems to me that's going to be the, you know, the final conflict, the biggest conflict. And yet here we are. We know a lot about the Faith of Seven. We know almost nothing about the White Walkers, right?
Yeah, Martin has been, you know, he's not given us any more information for what seems like 10 years now about what the others and White Walkers are doing.
You're right.
So I'd hope in his latest book, when it eventually does come out, that we will get a lot more information on what is going on in the north.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's possible that we won't. It's possible that it's, you know, we're going to hear a lot about the Drowned God and all that business. You know, Martin so far has not really given the White Walkers much of a culture. And of course, you know, we won't really see a system of religion if we don't see a culture developed. You know, if they're just avatars for the weather, there's really no need to have a religion attached to them now that Craster's gone, right? So
yeah, that's true.
Hey, man, I really appreciate you coming on to chop it up with me. You know, this book, Clash of Kings, really starts to play with a few of these concepts. And so I wanted to maybe lay a foundation or a groundwork for some of the themes that we'll meet in that book. And so anyway, I really appreciate it.
I think it's been a pleasure. And just having discussion about religion in general is sort of gave me a new appreciation of how rich his world is. I thinking through a few of these issues, like, really gives me insight. Like, Uman, he's done his homework. He put a lot of effort into making each religion feel distinct and, right, and reflective of the culture where it was born.
Yeah, exactly.